Blog Talk Radio. It's a nice, always a pleasure to have you join me, whether it's morning, evening, or night. It's Masonic Companion, and I'll be your host for the next while. I'm Dale Graham. Thank you very much for returning and providing support for the discussions on things that hopefully are of interest to people with a Masonic inclination. Primarily it would be brethren, won't it? But if you're interested in listening in on how Freemasons approach and reveal opinions on different topics, you're more than welcome. If you're thinking that anything that you hear in this type of program is definitive, well, if you take that completely out of context, then I suppose it is. If you do a little bit of work on your own, then you'll find that that there is a great deal to be learned and a great deal of value by developing context yourself. I want to talk to you can we function without espresso? We just need a little bit of espresso to get through this this next little while. And there you go. That's what I have, a little bit of espresso. I want to talk to you about some things that have been crossing my mind, and I know that you'll give me the kind of advice that I need to help put this into for this particular program into context again. It's always necessary. The program itself here today is I'm trying to bring this up here. It's on the topics that, as you know, that I pick for the that I write up for the shows come from programs, come from discussions with you and your ilk and type. What have I done? I'm getting a feedback here, so I'm going to try and knock that off, if you don't mind, somehow. I think that's done it. If if we can continue on. There we go. The program itself helps to pull together ideas, and that in itself is I think for me a way for us to build a firmer understanding of our ordering. So I want to share some thoughts with you this morning and get on. Well, I also want to later in the program talk about 17th century Freemasonry in England and Scotland. I think that might be of some interest. And then I want to emphasize, talk to you and bring in a bit of information to reveal, I think, the need to believe in yourself. And instead of talking about that specific, I want to give you an example that I think is rather remarkable. This happens to be the 24th day of November 2013. Here in Canada, this is, of course, Grey Cup Day. I want to congratulate the Rouge et d'Or of Laval University for their victory in the Vanier Cup yesterday over the Calgary Dinos. Scrappy Bunch put up a great competition. And I'm sure the old city of Quebec will be enjoying itself as the celebrations continue. This is the 322nd day of the year. It's only now 30 days until Christmas. Brought to my mind when I was looking at, again, Masonic context, of course, the feast of St. John the Baptist and St. John the Evangelist. The feast of St. John the Baptist, of course, is the 24th of June, and St. John the Evangelist is the 27th of December. During the 18th century, this St. John the Evangelist, the 27th of December, was the favored day by the Grand Lodge of Scotland, the Ancient Grand Lodge of England, and the Grand Lodge of All England at York. They installed their Grand Masters on the feast day of John the Evangelist, St. John the Evangelist. And it's interesting that the 24th was favored by the Premier Grand Lodge of England, the Grand Lodge of Ireland, and the Grand Lodge of Ireland. But here's something that was, I think, speaks about a resonance in time, that the day that the United Grand Lodge of England was formed, not 1717, you know better than that, was on the 27th of December, 1813, St. John the Evangelist Day. That's, you pull together the ancients and the moderns, don't you? Well, of course you do. And now we sit coming in very close to the winter solstice on the 21st of December. The solstice is when the sun at noon appears at its lowest altitude above the horizon. The earth tipping furthest away, in a sense, you know, that wobbly ball with a stick going through its poles. That little wobbly orbit, well, that little wobbly orbit is taking us a little further away. And that day we find the longest night, don't we? Yes, of course. And you remember our ancients, our people, the observers would realize that on that was the night that marked the return of the sun, the warmth that brought the seeds to life, so that we could survive another season. And if the gods were kind, and if we had done what we needed to do to appease them, then we would be rewarded. At the time, it was dreadfully serious. The issue is still dreadfully serious. Survival. Even though we've created the environments where we have a lot of people that can walk around without touching soil, without breathing fresh air, that contact with nature, that was important in the in post-Renaissance period. The Elizabethan poets giving us that natural sense, the superiority of natural man. Well, you know, we and the arts today, it seems that we've redefined, we haven't created, but we've redefined the idea of artificial, of unnatural. I think we can be held accountable for trivializing a major portion of, you know, of what's incredibly important to our existence. The food we eat, the air we breathe. But we've institutionalized those types of things. We've institutionalized that concern. So I no longer have to be concerned because I've entrusted that to our scientists. And the oversight of that is entrusted to our elected officials. I can trust that they are taking care of the to the utmost the sense of the greater good. It's odd when I say it that way, when we think of it that way, that the question of the greater good becomes almost a libelous term. We can be not set our cynicism aside. We live well. Not without complications. It's not necessarily a simple world that we live in. I don't know if it's if 100 years from now it'll make sense that we have lots of people that can walk around on 4-inch heels and not really be too concerned about what that does to their spines and things. I think that's pretty much the way it's always been. We're a victim of slaves of fashion, I guess, as Byron would tell us. Anyway, do you care? What's your help with a notion of being what it is about Freemasonry that may reveal more about what we have to do to round it out, to really make the experience a fulfilling one. Only you can determine what that is. I couldn't possibly come up with a definition of what a fulfilling experience is for another man. That's up to him. What I would do, of course, if you will allow, is make these comments as if there is somebody out there listening who may not be as fulfilled as he wants or needs. And in that case, perhaps he will stumble across some fragment of an idea here that will be useful to him. Being a Freemason isn't as nearly as precarious as the art of becoming one. The easy bit is the startling realization the questions asked of an initiate lead us to appease the inquisitors. they're in a way leading questions, always offered it very earnestly. So we want to answer affirmatively. I'm not saying we give up our capacity for objectivity, but in that moment, we want that connection. It's important to us. But when we were giving those questions, we're realizing the answers, and we hear ourselves answering very odd questions. They should probably come to us with a disclaimer. The disclaimer should be, you're going to answer a simple question. You know, answer it as well as you can and as candidly as you are. But these are, if you are a man of conscience, these are questions that will eat away at your soul. Well, nobody says that at the time. We don't say, well, this one's a man of conscience, this one isn't. This one we can't tell. This one is. This one isn't. We don't do that. We're not sifting seeds here. But maybe as a general disclaimer, you know, this will eat away at your soul. Dressing the part enables us to join the chorus. We'll come through the door and go through these this experience. Mute. You murmur very few actual words, one-syllable answers. And that's all that's expected. Not a great deal of discourse back and forth. Contemplation. Only that word is never really used. Very few lodges provide the candidate with a chamber of reflection before the initiatory process. Very few. We should ask ourselves seriously why we do that to the candidate, why we limit the candidate's experience that way. It's very peculiar. Not that we do limit it, but we don't ask the question. We join the chorus, though. You fit in. Complying. Wear your business suit and tie. And the rest, your place, the order, your learning experience will begin. But it comes with expectations. So not in words, but in concepts. In the initiation, you try and follow the flow of the language, but really the sentences are strung together into really quite interesting concepts, using that inner conversation that we each have in our minds. That's what the chorus allows us to experience. And that first conversation isn't with the brethren around. It's within your own mind. What is this? Am I liking this? Where is this taking me? A great deal of uncertainty, more questions than answers. But that inner conversation becomes quite enriched. It's not an inner conversation of dread. It may contain elements of doubt, but there's an element of safety in it as well because of the support felt. A great deal of encouragement. See, we don't feel that there's a cost to it. That I'm going to be revealed. That before I can understand that I'm stepping into something that has generally to do with character development, which any thinking man will realize has to do with change, challenge, honesty, authenticity, all that unpleasantness, intimacy, emotion, a measure of my intellectual capability, truthfully, Oh, yes. Simple things if you're a child. Frightening things if you're a grown man. I know there are other bold out there that will say, simply, this all doesn't matter. You're absolutely right. It doesn't matter until it does matter. So the inner conversation continues. And we like it. It's very, very pleasant. Mixed into it? Absolutely. We don't listen to the wisdom of the ages until we listen to that inner voice. Call it common sense. That process that we jealously save until reminded of its vastness, fearful of giving away our mediocrity to find the potential within us. What do you have to trade? What do you have to lose? We have our sense of mediocrity to lose. Man, we hang on to that tightly. It's like being near our mother's breast. Don't move away from that. Something's wrong. Always return to that spot. It's so familiar. The ancients. All the opinion pieces speak to us about the feel and experience of a philosophical life. To make sense of the volumes of opinion accumulating around us, we require proofs that are consistent and valid. How else would we do it? Walk around superstitious, head down, listening and following the thoughts of that somebody else has developed without giving them our own second thought, without applying our own common sense to the experience? Man, through 600 years of history, older members have always demanded familiarity. You know, whatever happens around the lodge, they want it to be familiar. And we use their words. It has nothing to do with change, but they want that change to be familiar. The more, and here's where we can say, well, the more progressive those oldest elder statesmen of the lodge are, the more progressive will be the capacity for adaptation, for changes needed to move the lodge forward. Well, yes, of course. It's an interesting little ruler to measure progress. If a lodge deteriorates, lets its infrastructure deteriorate, I think that's a really interesting metaphor for what goes on inside that lodge. I've never seen that metaphor fail. Where the infrastructure matters, where there's a forthrightness and a sense of future, the thinking within that lodge is similar. Where things are worn and broken, where there is no more reflection of dignity, but of a time gone past, the thinking is that same, that the glory of the organization is past, that we're clinging to something as if drowning. And we return to those points, as I feel, are points of mediocrity that are familiar. There is nothing to fear. But of course, when we start to think of the notion of changing that, we bare our breast to the idea of being criticized. Everybody does that. Better to be compliant. But that demand for familiarity is important. Youthful members at the same moment have demanded change. I say that in the kindest way. And the craft has always said yes to each. Yes, we must be familiar. And yes, we must change. It's theological without dogma. Now, picture in your mind. Picture in your mind, how does that occur? But it does in these successful lodges. That's the wonder. That's the beauty of this. That yes, we make change, but it is important to respect it. Call it the landmarks. It's important to bring forward the language of before. That's where our continuous understanding links us with our past. The link that you feel within your breast for 600 years of Masonic teachings, of Masonic process, we would think that you and I sitting in a lodge 600 years ago as a 21st century Freemason would experience some degree of familiarity. Of course we would. In part because we would be looking for it. Today, if you look for the familiarity and all the change around you, it is there. That's the beauty of the craft. If you choose not to, if you choose to turn your back on all change, then you will never find what is familiar about the changes occurring. That is your limit. That's not the limit of the craft. The craft is far deeper. The once upon a time, the engine driving Freemasonry is to root out hypocrisy, replacing complacency and ignorance with knowledge. This is the battlefield where that is fought. Ignorance and complacency are very, very powerful, insidious, cancerous. Knowledge, it's where the strength is. Complacency and ignorance may be powerful, but knowledge is power, not a blade. Knowledge. This coming from somebody who was raised in the religion developed by aesthetics. Yeah. Contemplatives. There were no firsts to covet. 600 years ago, what was the first? What were they protecting? Oh, well, we have to protect the vote of 1717. Well, Dale, it hasn't happened yet there, son. You've been sitting too near the fire, sniffing the fumes again there, sonny, you know. Or you've been eating bad clams again. You've been a little bit feverish there, boy. Go sit down on that rock. You'll be fine. There were no firsts. Oh, well, we have to go along with the Constitution. There you go again, Dale. What is this Constitution you're talking about? It doesn't exist. It won't exist for, you know, about 300 years. So sit yourself down. Yeah, I'm feeling better now. What about ritual? Well, Dale, we really, ritual is what it is. We don't have, the bunch down the road, they're doing something similar, but it's different. We don't have ritual. So you mean I could come up with my own? Well, Dale, you probably could, but nobody pay attention to you, you idiot. Yeah, but you might pay attention to some other idiot from somewhere else that's a little smoother and convincing. Don't you worry. We'd know him when we see him. We'll keep an eye on the strangers. Don't you worry about that. But the ritual, we'll get around to that, Greg. You know, that's probably not a bad idea. We need to sit down and think about that one a little bit. So the word first, the covet, we didn't have to, this need to protect. To, you know, you go, veil, you know, I think we tuck this sense of mediocrity into this notion of protecting these, the firsts. And we covet them. We're protective, oh, we're ruthlessly protective of them. Provenance, oh, my goodness. That's, we're all thinking we're Sotheby's, you know. The oldest painting in the planet, the oldest manuscript in the planet. Doesn't really, makes it nice and old, but it doesn't validate what's on it, does it? No. Unless we read what's on it and try and understand and make sense of it. Oh, it's written and it's very old, so therefore everything must be valid and accurate. Far from it. Only until our historians tear into it and find the truth. There is now, there is a sense of now, like what's happening today, this sense of me, you know. But that became, through the initiatory process, it became us. Today's goals and accomplishments became tomorrow's forgotten moments. No matter the earnestness, the Freemason learns to face himself in the mirror each day until he stops running away. He stops closing his eyes. Then he understands the steps and stages of improvement and self-awareness. Rash judgment ceases to be attributable. It's not my fault. I'm a victim of circumstance. I would be so much better if I hadn't been subjected to, you know, the liberating movements of the 50s and 60s and 70s. Grow up, Dale. You're still sitting on that rock waiting for your head to clear the air, Dale. We cease to become a promise of a better day to come and begin to realize it is a proof expected of us. Oh, you know, it'll all be better tomorrow. You know, I'm becoming something. Don't you worry about it. There is a proof. Prove it. You good? You done something? Freemasonry is rubbed off? Prove it. Oh, my goodness. The proof of my work I need to present to you? You mean the rough ashlar? My God, you know, that ought to be good enough for you. You need just, I can go over to that lodge and they're saying the rough ashlar is just perfect. What are you, uppity? You're expecting actual straight. What next? Creativity? Art? The work of the carvers? The work of genius? What next? And don't come near me with any of that loose talk. Because I'm a Freemason, and I was raised in a place where anything that was easy, anything I could do that was easy, wasn't worth anything. The only things of any value were things that were exceptionally hard. Now, if that doesn't speak to the need to look in the mirror and use common sense, what else does? There you have the interest. There you have the entrance into the mystery schools, huh? What the Egyptians and the Greeks had to offer to us. And so, to my friend Tom, hanging out there out in the western part of Ontario there, probably listening to the wind howling through his rafters right now, bringing some snows across the open fields. Yeah, we are connected with Egypt and Greece in that way. And if we are, we can lay claim to that kind of influence. If we can also lay claim to being good historians. So there you have my lamentation today. Becoming, being, what's now the mutuality of growth. So help me here. Set me on the straight and narrow. I'm not sure I've got any of this sorted. But I know Christmas is coming. And I know I'm darn well of an age where I don't need somebody else, the actions of somebody else, defining whether I'm going to enjoy it or not, or whether the traditional Christmas that I experience and that I so love and find endearing is in any way fragile. Let the advertisers do what they want. They have no... I feel sorry for them. Let people rush around with a fistful of money. That's fine. They're running around trying to find what? Something that you and I have already found. The understanding that you can't buy happiness. You can... Your fistful of money can become a bucket full of money and a pack and a bag and a box full of money. It's not the size of the container. There's no happiness in that. Where we find the tradition is in our very being. This is where you begin to step up and show leadership. Be subtle about it. Gentlemen, you want a traditional Christmas? Well, in days gone by, transportation wasn't easy. So everything would not necessarily have happened on the clock. Where in the hell did you ever get that idea? Things happened when they happened. And it was the Christmas season. And when you could put your tools down and complete the jobs that were important for you to do and take care of perhaps your livestock. And when you could do that and get the cart full and all the kids in it and everybody bundled up and you could travel over, then that when we met, that was Christmas. Whether it was morning or afternoon. And you'd be welcomed, you know. That's Christmas. The welcome. The fact that you can smile more during that time of the season for no apparent reason but the fact that it's Christmas in your heart. Those are the actions of those are the deeper actions of a Freemason. To be able to withstand the challenge. Let's say it's gray. Remember, on a gray day, you can see further because there's no reflections, no shadows. That's what I mean. It's wonderful. Shades of gray. It's beautiful. It brings a different context than you see any other time of year. Light plays with it, plays with their eye, plays with their imagination. So you bring in, 30 days? You bring that forward. And you might as well start by letting it leak out now. It's not going to leave a stain on your shirt. Nobody's going to notice. But you will. That inner conversation. Have you wondered how to do it? Well, this is what Freemasonry teaches us. This is how you do it. You bring it. You bring your A game every day. Oh, no, don't accept seconds as the best. Never, never. Don't lie to somebody else and say that they deserve a credit when they don't. That's just flat out wrong. And it's improper. But give credit where credit is due. As it is due. No need to be harsh. That never got anybody anywhere. Unless you're coming up to somebody that has lost all sense of dignity, then harshness does have its place. But generally, we need the voice of reason, where we're able to control our emotion. Oh, my goodness. Huh? Imagine that. I keep wondering if I'm going to be challenged one day on for a Masonic companion by some senior, august, robust, muscular fellow who's just going to rip into me about anything to do with nostalgia, anything to do with the contemplation. I'm wondering, how will I control my disdain for that kind of encounter? Would you mind a little object lesson? Would you? I always find them kind of interesting. Just a little one here. Nothing too breathtaking, I think, but one that makes sense. Everybody is a genius, but if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will live its whole life believing that it is stupid. You know, if a quote like that was good enough for Albert Einstein, it's good enough for Dale sitting on the rock waiting for his head to clear. You know, I think I can live well. Stupid fish can't climb a tree. Well, remember that. Keep that quote in mind. Here's a little object lesson du jour. Just a fantastic little piece of work here. This fellow, I'll tell you the name of the fellow after. You try and piece it together in your own mind. It'd be a little bit of a puzzle, huh? There's many examples like this, but this is one that I think is sort of, it is contemporary. It's a good thing. And by the way, if you're sitting in your great big comfortable chair and you've got your most favorite beverage, chin chin. that's good. There, I haven't been bitten by any snakes in the last hour, and my cough seems to have cleared up. And if you're feeling a little chill, push pause here, run off, get an elixir that takes care of that chill, and come on back. Here you go. This is the, it's about a fellow that waited 48 years. And the proof of this came on the 4th of July last year. Okay. The Nobel Prize winning physicist waited for a sight of the eponymous Higgs boson, the God particle of media headlines, for 48 years. But the waiting was not over for the man, who had to endure another year of speculation of a different sort before his achievement was finally capped on the 8th of October this year by the joint award of the Nobel Prize to himself and to another man, François Englert of the Université Libre de Bruxelles. In a final nail-biting twist, the announcement of his long-awaited victory was delayed by an hour as the committee struggled to reach the famously reclusive man. Unlike Samuel Beckett's Vladimir and Estragon, who waited for Godot in vain, this man had been successful. Watching on the internet as the Nobel Committee explained that it had given the prize for the theoretical discovery of a mechanism that contributes to our understanding of the origin of mass of subatomic particles. The world was flooded. The physics world was watching, all but one. The man had gone on holiday to avoid the media storm. Without a phone, in a prepared statement released at the University of Edinburgh, he expressed his humble thanks and said, "I hope this recognition of fundamental science will help raise awareness of the value of blue sky research." Everyone has heard of Higgs boson, even if you don't know what it is or why physicists give it such huge importance. For most of the last half century, this man had lived a quiet life away from the spotlight. Now, in the space of a few years, he has become a celebrity and public property. How does he feel to have seen his theory prove correct after waiting so long? Did he ever doubt his theory or worry that he was wrong as thousands of scientists and engineers devoted their professional careers in pursuit of the boson? Now that the eponymous particle is found, how does he react, with relief or trepidation that his life will irrevocably be changed? What does he foresee as the future of physics? These are the questions that we had a chance to discuss with him during the last 4 years, as he lived through the dramatic days that have moved a theory from speculation to lore, establishing for all time some of the most profound implications about the nature of the universe. In 1964, this fellow and five other independent of him produced a theory about the nature of matter and the fundamental forces of nature with remarkable consequences. The theory assumes that the universe is filled with some weird stuff, which has become known as the Higgs field. We have been immersed in this essence forever and been unaware of it. The idea that there is a ghostly presence everywhere, seemingly invisible, but which can be made manifest only when some clever people smash pieces of atoms into one another at almost the speed of light, sounds dangerously like the tale of a gullible public being told that their king, who was in reality naked, was clothed in wonderful raiment visible only to the highly intelligent. Even some renowned physicists had their doubts. Nonetheless, the theory had some remarkable successes. It explains why the sun barely stays alight. The force converting its hydrogen fuel into helium and liberating energy so feeble that the sun, instead of expiring almost immediately, has survived billions of years. Long enough for evolution to have worked its magic, producing sentient humans, collections of atoms capable of knowing the universe. That's you and I. These things also explain how the basic particles of matter, such as electrons and quarks, can form molecules and atoms rather than flying around at the speed of light in some form of cosmic goo. In summary, they explained how the universe had erupted in a big bang some 13.8 billion years ago, and how it is today full of shapes and forms rather than being a bland morass. It is easier to be Shakespeare or Beethoven than a theoretical physicist, is how this fellow was introduced at the Borders Book Festival in Melrose during June 2012. Being in Scotland, it was suggested that changing a few words in Macbeth or a few notes of Mendelssohn's Hebrides Overture would still leave wonderful works of art. Change a mere handful of symbols in this fellow's equations, however, and they would not work. The theory is excitingly conceptual. constructed from beautiful mathematical structures. Had this been a symphony or a work of literature, its value would have been recognized several decades ago. However, the ultimate value of a physical theory should not be decided by public opinion, but by experimental test. Among the sextet of theorists that developed this fellow alone identified a means of testing the theory by a direct experiment. He drew attention to an ephemeral a particle known as the Higgs boson, which the theory implies must exist. Find it and confirm that it behaves as the theory predicts, and you have made a major breakthrough in understanding. No such entity was known in 1964. No one, least of all this fellow, anticipated that nearly half a century would pass before the issue would be settled. The idea leading to the Higgs boson is similar to something quite familiar. The nature of light as an electromagnetic wave. A compass needle will point towards the north magnetic pole as it senses the presence of the Earth's magnetic field. Add energy to a magnetic or electric field in the form of heat, say, and it will stimulate an electromagnetic wave such as a radio wave or a sunbeam. In quantum mechanics, such waves consist of statico bundles of photons, massless particles of light. A similar idea applies to the Higgs field. Add energy and Higgs bosons, the analogs of the photons, will emerge. The Higgs field is ubiquitous. Everywhere. Unlike a light, you cannot switch it off. This is because the vacuum of space is never empty, but according to quantum theory, is filled with ephemeral particles of matter and antimatter flitting in and out of existence, including the Higgs field. As analogy, imagine space as an infinitely deep, placid lake whose surface is so smooth that you are unaware of it in everyday affairs. Supply energy, however, and waves form. In the real universe, these ripples, which herald the Higgs boson, are the telltale signs of that profound, all-pervading stuff, the Higgs field. A big difference between a photon and the Higgs boson is that it is easy to create a particle of light as it has no mass. A torch battery is sufficient. The Higgs boson, however, is massive, weighing in at more than an atom of iron. To produce this beast out of the vacuum requires a huge concentration of energy, greater than has existed since the first moments of the Big Bang. This technological challenge was beyond reach for at least 20 years after the theory was formulated. But the ideas underlying the Higgs boson increasingly interested the physics community. As the Gang of Six laid claims to the original insights, I asked this fellow how his name had become to such prominence. In his opinion, it was partly due to an accident. 3 years after the original papers appeared, this fellow met the leading American theorist, a fellow named Dr. Ben Lee, at a physics conference in Rochester, New York. Up to that time, their ideas had been largely ignored, but Lee had realized the significance. At the end of that conference, Dr. Lee met this fellow at a party, and their conversation had a far greater impact than either had anticipated. I was standing with a plate in one hand and a glass of wine in the other, being interrogated by Ben about my papers. I didn't realize that 5 years later, Ben would be the keynote speaker at the High Energy Physics Conference in Chicago, he said with a gentle laugh. In 1972, Dr. Lee must have recalled that conversation and forgotten the wider provenance of some of the ideas, as in his talk he referred prominently to the massive Higgs boson, which is justifiably as only Higgs drew attention to the special aspect of the theory, and also the Higgs field, which has a wider provenance. Dr. Tom Kibble, in particular, having made unique contributions. But this fellow had not been in Chicago. The first that he knew of this was when he met a colleague, Ken Peach, in the Edinburgh University Staff Club. Peach just returned from the conference and said, "Man, you're famous." Dr. Lee had made this fellow famous, but finding the boson was out of reach at that time. What was this fellow's reaction back then? At that time, it looked as if the question would not be answered in my lifetime. In the 1980s, I began to realize that finding the boson might be possible, but the time scales were completely unclear. In 1983, the Americans started designing a machine known as a superconducting supercollider, capable of finding the Higgs boson. It was a pragmatic but ambitious approach, which involved building a gargantuan ring of magnets underground in an 87-kilometer tunnel. Their strategy was to produce the boson by means of conventional technology and brute force. This fellow says that for the first time, it began to look as if I might see the answer after all. But this burst of optimism was quickly dashed, as in 1993, the Americans quit. The future of particle physics, including the quest for the Higgs boson, was now in jeopardy. The cancellation of the superconductor collider was a disappointment because they should have been able to find the boson with their technology. Then the Large Hadron Collider plans came through. Given some years of technological development, I began to hope again it might happen after all while I was around to see it. This emotional roller coaster continued, the fellow recalls. Perhaps I was more optimistic than I should have been, as I was ignorant of some of the technological challenges facing the Large Hadron Collider. Compared to the supercollider, the Large Hadron is relatively compact, a ring the size of the Circle Line in the London Underground. To produce the necessary conditions in this device would require novel techniques, however. There were any number of possible showstoppers, technological barriers that could ruin the project. It took 20 years to design and build the Large Hadron Collider. In addition, scientists and engineers from around the world had to construct detectors the size of battleships to record the results and tease out the Higgs boson, which would live for less than a billionth of a second. This old fellow luckily had not worried about this. Eventually, in 2008, the Large Hadron Collider was complete. Beams of protons circulated, collided, and experiments were eagerly anticipated. Then there was a component failure so serious that the repairs took over a year to complete. By then, I was getting frustrated, the old fellow says, as he reviewed the tale of two steps forward and one step back. Finally, all was well, and in 2010, the data began to pour in. Looking for the Higgs boson is analogous to rolling a pair of dice inside a closed box. If sixes happen every time, you can be certain that the dice are special. The boson exists. However, if sixes happen once every 36 throws, the results are no more than random chance, and there is no Higgs boson. Opening the box is the analog of smashing two protons head-on at the Large Hadron Collider and detecting the debris. Recording the characteristics of this byproducts, their varieties, energies, and flight paths of the constituent particles is analogous to determining the numbers on our metaphorical dice. Correlations among the particles may show them to be the debris from the decay of an ephemeral boson, the dice each being a six. If only it were that simple. In practice, what happens is that the sixes turn up slightly more often than mere chance, and you have to decide whether this is significant evidence for the boson or mere vagaries of luck, in which case there is no boson. Perform a few throws, and if it is not possible to tell the answer after millions of throws, clear access will become more, success will become more certain. By the end of 2011, there was a hint that the dice were coming up six more often than mere chance. But many more throws would be needed to establish this with confidence. If there were no breakdowns and the Large Hadron Collider continued to work well, then the autumn of 2012 seemed to be the earliest that a clear answer would emerge. Thus it was that I found myself in Melrose in June 2012 talking with this old fellow. Before an answer was known, the total cost of the enterprise had been estimated in the order of 10 billion euros. In the public's perception, this has all been done with the purpose of finding Higgs boson. So my first question to Melrose was to the old fellow, if tomorrow you found a mistake in your arithmetic, would you tell anybody? It was a rhetorical question, as there are no mistakes. The basic ideas of the theory have been used like pieces of Lego building other theories, which have been tested experimentally. As the 21st century began, awareness that the boson could be found began to take hold. Higgs boson became a brand, the answer to cryptic crosswords as an anagram within the clue. Gosh, big's no way to describe in it, though it's important in theory. One reason why the public has been so enamored could be the solid ordinariness of the name, one syllable long. Had it been Kibble or Englert, for example, less attention might have been ensued. 2 weeks after the event in Melrose, I met the old fellow again in the hilltop Sicilian town of Therese. We were in a summer school giving lectures to the new generation of young particle physicists. All of them knew the old fellow. Most had never met him, nor did not know what he looked like. Unlike some who hog the limelight and are highly visible at conferences, the old fellow has for most of the half century been primarily a name, the man himself having managed to maintain a life of peace and quiet, and devoting much time to activism on behalf of the campaign for nuclear disarmament. He stopped when they extended their campaign to opposing nuclear power. They couldn't quite decide the difference between a weapon and power and the use of it. That was rapidly changing, and events were about to overtake him much earlier than he had expected. CERN had planned some months before to make a progress report on the 4th of July. As the date approached, it was like being at the eye of a hurricane, as rumors as to the likely birth announcement of the Higgs boson raged around the globe. The man himself was in a haven of peace in the Reese. A Dutch film crew who were making a documentary about the Higgs boson had come for 3 days. On the 30th of June, they were with the old fellow in the restaurant Venus for lunch. Higgs' aide and colleague had been trying to find out how significant the 4th of July event might be, as the old fellow was due to return to Scotland with no plans to go to CERN. He had contacted the CERN press in the morning to ask, "What should we do?" Suddenly, the lunch was interrupted when his phone rang. I saw the code was plus 41, which is Switzerland, so I thought it was the CERN press office calling me back. But it was John Ellis, a senior theorist at CERN. So as not to disrupt the lunch, the old fellow left the table and went over to the window to take the call. He returned, turned around to see the film crew had set up their equipment and were filming the moment. The crew motioned to him to continue acting naturally. So the old fellow started a conversation saying, "Psst, it's John Ellis saying we should go out to CERN." The old fellow said, "If Ellis says that, then we should go." If there was a moment when the old fellow knew at last that theory was about to become lore, that was it. After 48 years of waiting, instead of a feeling of triumph, his immediate reaction was of panic. His life had become increasingly taken over in the previous couple of years, and the media attention given to a personality. The discovery of the Higgs boson would have unexpected consequences. I had in a way been dreading the occasion and being prepared for how to cope with it, and suddenly realized that I was going to have to face up to this event in my life some months earlier than I had expected. Two experiments at CERN were chasing the Higgs boson, and both announced their results to a packed auditorium and to several millions watching, thanks to the World Wide Web. Itself one of the unexpected creations that had arisen out of the international quest for knowledge at CERN. When the first experiment announced that they had strong evidence of the boson, the audience burst into prolonged applause. When the second speaker announced that they too had found the same phenomena independently and with the same conclusions, there was cheering. Former directors general who had gathered for the occasion, including state octogenarians, were slapping one another on the back like excited children. We were witnessing a seminal moment in human culture. What had been conjecture for so long was now on the tablets for all time. The old fellow recalled before the announcement he was reasonably sure that his ideas were correct and that the boson was there to be found, but was not prepared for the overwhelming emotions that erupted. It was very moving. I burst into tears. It was partly the result of the audience reaction, their euphoria. There was a huge buzz. I was in England watching online then as well with a crowd of physicists at the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory in Oxfordshire. Even as kibitzers, we felt a sense of living through a historic moment. Only 3 weeks had elapsed since I had last talked with him in Melrose, but it seemed a lifetime. The questions from the audience on that occasion had included, is this a seminal moment in culture or is it a media creation? If it is real, what do we know now that we didn't before, and what happens next? The answer to the first question was already obvious. Many of the scientists had devoted 20 years to the endeavor. The old fellow had waited for more than half a lifetime. What had been conjecture was now confirmed as reality. Knowledge about the fundamental nature of the universe that would have been there as long as humanity itself passed down the generations as we ourselves had been taught about the insights of Isaac Newton, Archimedes, and Pythagoras. The mysterious power of mathematics had been confirmed once more. The ability of equations written on pieces of paper to know nature. If a thunderbolt had come through the roof of the auditorium at that moment, with the voice of Charlton Heston berating impertinent humans for entering where we had no right, I could hardly have been more overwhelmed than in those moments when I felt contact with the infinite. Cautious or wise, counsel said that the discovery of the boson was probably too late for it to have to affect the destination of any award that same year. But this did not prevent a media circus generating controversy by making speculations on how to select at most three out of a cast of worthy characters. The debate continued to rage all the way up until this year's announcement. The question became not so much who will win, but who will share the prize with this one old fella. Three at most can share a Nobel. And as we have seen, at least six had similar ideas to the old fellow in the halcyon days of 1964 when the story began. So there was a degree of surprise when only two names were announced on the 8th of October, 2013. One was Englert, and the other was the old guy. But for deserving third place, Tom Kibble, Jeffrey Gladstone, or even the CERN laboratory itself were among the numerous suggestions. However, I think that the Nobel Committee has made a profound decision. Egler produced a prize-winning book with the U.S.-Belgian theoretical physicist Robert Brout. Brout sadly passed away last year. Had he been alive, he would have completed the trio. A year after our memorable first visit on the 30th of June, 2013, the old fellow and I were once again in Iris, in the same restaurant where he had received the call to CERN. I asked him how the reality had compared with the anticipation, although he had been thrust into the limelight for some time before the announcement. He realized that experimental confirmation would make an order of magnitude difference. And had it? Yep, a few orders of magnitude, judging by the numbers of incoming emails. Although his face is not recognized like that of a TV personality, in his home city of Edinburgh, he has increasingly stopped on the street. I had noticed the change myself between our performance in Melrose and when I introduced him at the Edinburgh Festival in August that year, just 4 weeks after the confirmation. In Melrose, everyone was thrilled that the old fellow was there on stage. The applause was loud but standard length. In Edinburgh, it was quite singular. When an audience applauds before an event, it's as if there is a metronome in your head which tells you when you expect the clapping to die down. But it didn't. It went on and on. I realized this is their boy. I thought, we don't need to say anything. We can stand here for an hour. Let them applaud, and they will be happy. How does the discovery affect our mind view of the universe and future of physics? In the public's mind, the Large Hadron Collider was made in order to find the Higgs boson. Is this a great success for physics? The old fellow was cautious. The Large Hadron Collider was built to explore many things, not just the boson. There could be a reaction like, okay, we can close the machine down now. It's expensive and it has done its job. That particular aspect of boson was possibly too successful at the expense of the other things. The Large Hadron Collider is currently being refurbished and will start up again in a little over a year from now with more power. Higgs is hoping that when the Large Hadron Collider restarts, it will find evidence of supersymmetry and dark matter particles. Therein is the sober message of what we know, and more relevant perhaps, what we do not yet know. The stuff that we are made of and whose existence is now beginning to be understood, thanks to discovery of the boson, constitutes only about 5% of the total. Most of the universe is made up of dark matter, which tugs the galaxies by gravity, but which does not shine. The particles that make this, the dominant stuff, remain to be discovered. After the ancient Greeks started musing about the nature of matter, at least following the discovery of the Higgs boson, we are at the end of the beginning, not the beginning of the end. We are made of mere flotsam in a sea of dark matter. What this is made of and whether there are further dark Higgs bosons to be found is for the future. Theorists suspect that dark matter may consist of supersymmetric particles whose existence will be within reach of the Large Hadron Collider in the next round of experiments. Whether the existence of supersymmetry will be revealed within a few years, or whether we are at the start of another long wait comparable to that which Higgs endured, we cannot know. Congratulations to Dr. Peter Higgs, the winner of this year's Nobel Prize in Physics, who waited 48 years for researchers to confirm his theory. But in some ways, he grew to dread that. Whew. There you have it, brethren. So I know we're all there applauding. We know enough to applaud the greatness. And the applause will never stop. It goes on to this day. So, not that the Masonic reference to Pythagoras is lost to anybody. But take a look. Pick out what else was being framed in those quotes, eh? It wasn't just the mathematics, was it? But it was. It's the purity of that. It's the finding, the clarity, the honesty, the beauty of the mathematics. That I wish that I had been taught by mathematicians who were artists. What a different world. I'm so fortunate that at 64 I've come to realize the beauty in the mathematics, that it's around in everything, in nature. It describes something very pure and honest. So I'll go back to the to the work tonight, this evening, of Pythagoras, and not just stop at his school. We know there's not a lot of information left about Pythagoras. A lot of it was destroyed when he passed away. But we also know quite a bit about the contributions that he made, and that alone is useful. But my goodness, take a serious look at the context. Take a serious look. There you have it. That's a little piece on the Higgs universe. 5% is known, and 95% of what we claim is unknown. And then this sense of completeness that's around us, the sentient creature that we became out of this bundle, this bag of atoms, that allows us to understand the universe, is also incomplete. But there is a great deal of knowledge. There is a great deal of understanding that we can't necessarily achieve, or can we? We have a sense of the great unknown. How are we doing so far? That sort of took a little bit of the stuffing out of me. I found that profound. And the takeaway, what do you take away? We're not schoolboys. It's refreshing when we know that somebody has the ability to prevail. Was he prevailing? He had something that he knew was right, was accurate, was beautiful. He had the math. But he also had that same question that the rest of us have, the question of the proof. So 48 years, was that long enough? The question of the proof would have continued on until it was established, until it was found, until it was discovered, whatever that day was. One day, 1,000 days, 1,000 years. It makes the time almost irrelevant, doesn't it? Herein, I think, is one of the, where we need to reach a little deeper into the experience of the scientists, for what it gives us. And I don't know, tell me, the listeners out there are a lot brighter than I am. Am I just sort of deluding myself? Am I sort of convincing myself of things Masonic that really aren't there? No, I don't think that there's something Masonic in everything of the universe. Come on. It is derivative. My goodness, yes, of course. But, help me. Well, you listen to this next part, and then, if you think that I've just lost it a little bit again and I'm sitting over on the rock waiting for my head to clear, in the dark thatched cottage, well, okay, maybe my head's still full of a little bit of the fumes. So leave me over in the rock or the stump. Maybe I've graduated. It's really 14th century and I'm sitting on the stump. There you go. Here's my thinking. If we were around the scientists, what do you learn? Well, the presence of the scientist teaches us perseverance. But not only that. Not only that. If we think that, you know, it teaches us a temperament. What is the scientific temperament? Well, you know, it's a disciplined temperament. Yes, you embrace routine and become comfortable with it, because out of the routine, there's a standards of measure. It's you standardize a lot of things. You take away the extraneous work to be able to focus on what is important, where you want to put the majority of your energy, which is your primary work. Well, we would see that if we're sitting at the table, the laboratory table, beside the great scientists. We would begin to experience that. The different personalities, so those that are isolated, those that are a bit impatient, under-socialized, don't know how to be conversant, and others that are well-read and sort of that, what today we call the Renaissance man, you know, well-read in a number of areas, curious, where the curiosity about their primary work spills over into other areas, into a curiosity about how you're doing, how your family is, a curiosity about whether the school is going to improve the parking, or a curiosity about the weather or about the local college football team, or whether there's serving something new in the menu down at the cafeteria. Always that pressing energy and curiosity. Well, we would also experience that. We would experience a person making small, quote, breakthroughs. And we would experience what a person does when they have had a proof, they've developed the mathematics, but they need a proof to validate their theory. So we would be around people who would live in the purity of a theory, in a world, a larger world of disclaimers, of cynics, of illiterates, people disinterested in the significance. So today, if we say, well, you know, if we go through a group of people and ask them about the significance of the Higgs boson, well, the majority of the people in the world won't necessarily know, if you just finished listening to the article that I gave you about Higgs boson, you may know something a little more than the average person out there. The significance you may appreciate a little deeper. In terms of what happens with particle physics from here, well, we're not trained particle physicists, so we'll have a renewed interest. And when there is some news that comes out about the Large Hadron Collider, we'll make a special note of reading it and trying to understand it. But that's not to say that the importance of the work is diminished, because the significance is not public. Well, in fact, it probably shouldn't be public. It's like saying that the significance of Beethoven is generated by public appeal and its record sales. Well, come on. We can sell a million pieces of Pablum and only one piece of Chateaubriand. The masses be the decider, but the masses don't decide greatness. Never have, unfortunately. So the things that we lose or we don't get to experience is the human effect. Now here we heard about Dr. Peter Higgs, who led a quiet and peaceful life. I find that remarkably pure. remarkably pure, that it separates from me the person doing, you know, the purity of his reasoning. He was doing it for the sake of science, at least in my mind. That, I think, is remarkable. And this clamor about who gets credit? Well, you know, the darn thing did have his name on it. And when, you know, when it was discovered? July or October, the announcement came out. And then even today, you know, it's breathtaking when you read that about the events and the experience. Stand there with the crowd in Edinburgh, applauding and applauding and applauding with no reason to stop, knowing to a person the uniqueness of what has just happened. We become part of history. You and I and everybody around you. We have lived during the time when the Higgs boson was confirmed. And where do we go from now? To find the roll up our sleeves and have our best scientists and our best sons and daughters. That's the other thing that the scientists will teach us. The gender doesn't matter. In that context, yes, you can be polite. Yes, you can be who you are when you step out and have all your tastes, whether they're macho and male and overstated, you know, from the weakness of ego, or whether you're just humble and go about your business. Doesn't really matter. That ethnicity matters? No, that doesn't. It's the idea. And at some point, the ability to communicate those ideas. So what's really important, we find, are in those laboratories are ideas. So you and I can appreciate the greatness of those minds in our own humble way. Really. That can take us so many places. And what does it, and where do we go from there? Where do we go? Ignorance is the curse of God. Knowledge is the wing wherewith we fly to heaven. William Shakespeare. Do you have any patience for me left today? Anything? Nothing? Something? I'm just going to tuck into it a little bit. Is it a good time to tuck into a little bit about 17th century Freemasonry in England and Scotland? Let me come back to that. I feel like I want to, that is like something that would define a show. Let me come back to that, if you don't mind. In the meantime, your patience has been once again astounding. Thank you so very much. I've just bought a copy of Henry Wilson Coyle Sr.'s Freemasonry Through the Sixth Century. And you know you have to find this a volume at a time. You can't just go out and buy the set. Of course not. You have to collect it. It's one of the things I think that's kind of curious about Freemasonry. We really don't approach it yet here as a science. So we'll get there one day. I'm sure. I guess I'm pretty sure. In the meantime, I hope that I've been entertaining. I hope that I've been useful to you on this, 328th day of the year. Here in this part of the world, the sun is coming out. And to help us to celebrate beautiful, beautiful snowfall, there's so much around us that gives us reason to pause and reflect. I hope that that I've been useful. I hope you'll come back. Thank you so very, very much for your support and encouragement. You will continue to look for the Mason in the man. Look for the Mason in you. You're in the process of becoming. May that process be continuous. I don't think I look at it so much as the journey. I tend not to understand what the hell that means. But it is the process. Here's a little bit of something for you as we part for the week. Committing acts of random Masonic kindness. What better way than to set the molecules racing toward Christmas? See you soon.